Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program showcasing radio productions from independent community stations across the country. We bring local stories to a national audience from a different location every week. I'm Dory Smith of Talk Nation Radio, produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. Today on Sprouts, an interview with singer-songwriter David Rovix.
We'll lie about the North Koreans and we'll lie about Iran and don't mention Israel. Keep those nuclear weapons out of this song and we'll all get together swell. And we'll liberate these people, we'll liberate their money, we'll liberate their soil. We'll liberate their airports, we'll liberate their harbors, and we'll liberate their oil. It's Operation...
David Rovix is well known for his powerful anti-war songs like the one we're listening to right now, Operation Iraqi Liberation, OIL. But we'll also be focusing on his songs about underreported news and lesser-known figures from world history. These are miners, revolutionaries, or farmers, like the ones from Ciudad, Mexico, who lost their incomes after the passage of NAFTA, the controversial North American Free Trade Agreement. In his song, Guanajuato, from the new CD, 10,000 Miles Away, David Rovix picks up a favorite theme.
I was raised in Guanajuato, that's where I was born. For 1,000 years, that's where my family grew the corn. Farming's what we lived by, and farming's what we knew. Then the gobierno signed NAFTA, and our farming days were through. I had to leave the village, there was no other way. I had to find work somewhere or starve if I should stay. In Ciudad de Mexico, I tried to survive, but the colonias were full, there was no work to stay alive. I went to Tijuana, the maquila factories. People living by the sewage, dying on their knees. It was then in desperation I knew I had to go. Leave the country I was born in, the only one I know. Across the unknown deserts to the other side, around the wall that stretches on 100 miles wide. I trudged on for days, I don't know how far I got, but I never knew in all my life the sun could be so hot. My feet had turned to blisters, my water bag run dry. I thought about mi madrecita as I looked up at the sky. I lay down for the last time, parched upon the ground. Maybe someday my body will be found. Eaten by the vultures, bones bleached in the sun. Maybe I'll go to heaven, if there is one. And I guess someone in California who wants to make their fields green, gonna have to find another Mexican to keep their dishes clean.
David Rovix, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Dory. Glad to be with you.
And so we've just listened to the song Guanajuato, and I wanted to play one of your songs in full so people could get a sense of how you tell a story. Just explain this one man's sorrow in the context of NAFTA.
Guanajuato is a song for one of the hundreds of would-be migrants from Mexico who die on the border every year. And, of course, it's connected to NAFTA because after NAFTA was passed, there was a tremendous increase in poverty and people losing their farms in Mexico and, of course, immigrating to Mexico City and California and other places. That's gone along with the militarization of the border, which has just pushed the death rate higher and higher.
You're writing about policy, but you're bringing it down to the impact of that policy on just one life.
Yeah, that's right, which I think is a really powerful way to tell a story, you know, because anybody can identify with another life, you know. It's all these universal things between humans, and so if you boil it down to one life, then I think it works really well to communicate.
And I want to sort of go back in history now into some of your songs, like Eureka Stockade, and that's on your new CD, 10,000 Miles Away. It's a true song, right, about the 1800s?
Yeah, true story, and I've been performing it pretty much every night for the past few weeks because I wrote it quite recently. And so far, I've stumped every audience that I've come across. Nobody knows that Australia was the first country in the world to get the 8-hour day, and I didn't know it until I was there. But they got it decades before anybody else, and as a direct result of a sort of rebellion of gold miners, which was not as big as the powers that be feared it was going to become, but the powers that be were building barricades around Melbourne and preparing for a siege, which never came. But the gold miners got pretty much everything they demanded and more, which was the state's way of trying to maintain the status quo, really, by giving them some land and other things so that they would stop threatening to overthrow the government, although they weren't ever threatening to overthrow the government, but they were organizing to stop paying license fees and for other things, and they got everything they asked for.
From every corner of the world, they came from all around. When in 1851 they struck gold upon the ground, every voyage was a long one, months upon the stormy sea. Some to seek their fortune, others escaping slavery. What they found on the gold fields was rule by brutish thugs, discrimination and taxation mixed with swinging billy clubs. The gold was getting scarcer and cops were getting worse. The diggers burned their licenses and vowed to end this curse. They swore an oath beneath the Southern Cross. They'd stand together and break the license laws. From 20 different nations they gathered here as one, in Ballarat beneath the southern sun. The crown tried to divide them, giving preference to some. The diggers wouldn't have it, they said it's all of us or none. They built a stockade while the redcoats massed nearby, and they heard the miners shouting, "We're ready now to die." The rebel miners waited for whatever lay in store, and on one December morning in 1854, the redcoats attacked the camp. Dozens there would fall amongst these brave gold diggers who'd risen to the call. They swore an oath beneath the Southern Cross. They'd stand together and break the license laws. From 20 different nations they gathered here as one, in Ballarat beneath the southern sun. The army thought it was over and things go their way. But when 15,000 miners rallied a month later on the day, the crown conceded everything, all of their demands. They'd won an end to license fees, the right to vote and land. So here's to Joe and Charlie, Waller and the rest. They drew the battle lines and put crown rule to the test. The diggers may have lost the battle, but they quickly won the day. And those shots fired in Victoria were heard 10,000 miles away. They swore an oath beneath the Southern Cross. They'd stand together and break the license laws. From 20 different nations, they gathered here as one in Ballarat beneath the Southern sun. They swore an oath beneath the Southern Cross. They'd stand together and break the license laws. From 20 different nations, they gathered here as one in Ballarat beneath the Southern sun.
I mean, I think really the lesson that we have to learn from the Eureka Stockade and from just countless other events in the history of labor struggles, as well as in the history of, you know, all sorts of other things on the planet throughout the world, is that direct action gets the goods. And when people take to the streets in large numbers, and militant protests and boycotts and rebellions and even just blocking up the streets and making their numbers felt, there's so many ways of doing that. And of course it can often be ineffective, but in so many cases it can be profoundly effective, and in fact is the only thing that consistently does actually result in changes happening. You know, enlightened politicians deciding to do the right thing is a very rare occurrence, and far more common is people taking to the streets in large numbers and being heard because they're scaring the pants off of the powers that be, that they might become more intransigent or more militant or less governable. You know, those who govern always realize that they need, at least to a significant extent, the consent of the governed. And when they lose that, they get scared.
From the school of the assassins to Argentina's dirty war, from Arizona to Nevada, we'll nuke our way to heaven's door. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. All say, can you see? We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. All say, can you see?
Then in the song From Kabul to Khartoum, you're talking about war as the reason for our losses of democracy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the hypocrisy of the American empire that says it's fighting for democracy and that it believes in democracy, when, you know, the reality is quite apparent that it believes in empire and it believes in dictatorships and it opposes democracy at every turn. That's what the song's about.
It seems to me that we're living in a time as Americans that there's just so much emphasis on the use of violence, the use of force. Can you just speak to that, you know, in terms of how you feel about it?
Well, yeah, I mean, the U.S. can't get its way through any means other than through force or through economic strangulation or through threats of these things. You know, it's a sure sign that the policies of a country that it's trying to impose in the world are not popular when these policies are resisted and can only be imposed through force. But that's the MO of the U.S. empire, is force, and it's terrible. I mean, it results in so much death, misery, and hatred, and sadness. It's just awful. And the numbers killed in the process of maintaining the U.S. empire are really staggering and sobering, and should cause anyone to make natural comparisons, such as to Nazi Germany.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. I'm Dori Smith, and we're speaking with singer-songwriter David Rovics about his more historical pieces, like St. Patrick Battalion, from the album Living in These Times.
My name is John Riley. I'll have your ear only a while. I left my dear home in Ireland. It was death, starvation, or exile. When I got to America, it was my duty to go enter the army and slog across Texas to join in the war against Mexico. And it was there in the pueblos and hillsides that I saw the mistake I had made. Part of a conquering army with the morals of a bayonet blade. And there amidst all these poor dying Catholics, screaming children, the burning stench of it all, myself and 200 Irishmen decided to rise to the call. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion and we fought on the Mexican side. We marched neath the green flag of St. Patrick, emblazoned with Erin Goldbrough, bright with the harp and the shamrock and Libertad para Mexicana. Just 50 years after Wolf Tone, 5,000 miles away, the Yanks called us a legion of strangers, and they can talk as they may. But from Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion and we fought on the Mexican side.
It's a story that so few people know, that people aren't happily, you know, lots of people are familiar with the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and the International Brigades in Spain, but people are far less aware of this kind of more organic and, you know, spontaneous example of the same kind of international solidarity in the form of the St. Patrick Battalion, these Irish and other folks, but mostly Irish folks who deserted from the U.S. Army during the U.S. invasion of Mexico in 1846. But then they actually took that desertion a step further. I mean, thousands of soldiers deserted, but they, 202 guys, they actually joined the Mexican Army and created the Mexican Army's only foreign legion and fought the U.S. in five different battles, and most of them were killed in battle, just like the Lincoln Brigade. And those who survived, most of them settled in what is now Mexico City. And it's an inspiring story, and one of many stories of that kind of selfless sacrifice and international solidarity, and, you know, people fighting for a cause that's much bigger than their own.
David Rovics, some people put their questions to the American people more delicately, let's say. I don't know, maybe that's because they want to try to convince more of a variety of people. But you're very direct in your musical references and in your poetry. Why do you choose to be so direct?
I mean, I like to imagine that I'm not too direct in the sense that I'm not beating people over the head and rather telling stories in a way that people can appreciate them, and where the sad stories are sad and the funny stories are funny, where people get something out of them and where it's art, you know. But yeah, it's much more direct than a lot of people that like to use mainly in metaphor. And I love that stuff. And I do a little bit of it, but not much. And I really love the folks who do it well. And I'm fascinated with artists like Silvio Rodriguez, who can be like a household name throughout the Spanish-speaking world. And yet he's in the Cuban parliament. He's a total left-winger, but he's very popular even among the right, you know, or just among all kinds of regular folks throughout Latin America. And I think it's because, of course, he's largely communicating in metaphor. He has like a popular song called The Unicorn. Nobody really knows quite what this unicorn is, you know, but everybody has their idea of what it is. And the left certainly has its idea of what the unicorn represents, and other people probably just don't think about it much, and it's just a nice song. And I think it's really impressive when you can do that. And I'd probably do it more if I got around to it. But I'm also content to tell stories where, you know, the story is about what the story is about, and it's not a metaphor for something else. Or there may be things, certainly, they can get out of it that are metaphors or instructive anecdotes for the modern age. But, you know, when you're telling the story about the gold diggers and their rebellion, I'm not making up metaphors to represent things. I'm just telling the story, but hopefully doing it in a way that's artistic and moving.
When the war to end all wars came, he knew it was a lie. He said he wouldn't fight for bosses, he wouldn't kill or die. He had black lung from the mines, but they called him fit to go. So he hid out in the mountains, out in the rain and snow. The cop who went to find him, this is what he said: I'm gonna bring him in, whether that's alive or dead. The people gained a martyr who would never leave our side, and 10,000 workers marched when they heard that Ginger died. Let's remember the departed, and for us the things they gave, as we're gathered here by Ginger Goodwin's grave.
You write about coal miners of yesterday, you know, Ginger Goodwin in British Columbia, who was killed for trying to stand up for workers' rights. But in that story, I was reminded of American factory workers at aluminum plants, and I read about them in Mother Jones recently. They worked at this exhausting labor to get their pensions, only to learn a new owner had sold their factory and their pensions were gone.
Yeah, I think there's actually more and more about the early part of the 20th century that becomes increasingly relevant today, because this was before people won the kinds of reforms that at least we had for a while, which we're continually losing, it seems. You know, the eight-hour day and full employment and safety on the job and health care benefits and all this kind of stuff. These are the things that people like Ginger Goodwin were fighting for. That's almost a bit, you know, strange to remember this struggle that folks then were fighting for reforms that are largely gone now.
Glory, hallelujah. Beecher's Bible in his hand. With 2,000 of New England's best and bravest sons, Captain Brown fought in Kansas with a Bible and a gun. When
in the name of God, he held his pistol pointed at the doctor's head. In the name of God, he pulled the trigger. Now the doctor's lying dead.
It's interesting to contrast the portrait you drew of John Brown with the one you would draw later of the murderer of Dr. Tiller.
Yeah, it seems to me, I mean, I'm not a religious scholar, but it seems to me that Jesus is not a neutral figure, that Jesus clearly stood up for the oppressed. Jesus would have been on John Brown's side. Jesus would have been an abolitionist, and certainly John Brown thought so, and certainly lots of other Christians thought so at the time. Not all Christians, you know. The Southern Baptists didn't think so. And certainly that's true with the murder of Dr. Tiller. I think Jesus would not have gone around killing doctors. I think Jesus had a lot of sympathy for women and would not be a so-called pro-lifer today. Of course, it's all conjecture, but it's all really quite consistent in my mind anyway. And these are, of course, both songs that reference God and Christianity. But I think John Brown was a far better Christian than whoever it was who murdered Dr. Tiller.
David Rovics, what kind of reaction have you been getting to performing the song that you wrote about Brad Will, the photojournalist killed while he was taking a film of his killers in Mexico? Because I noticed when you performed that song in Connecticut at the Wrench in the Works in Willimantic, people seemed very emotional about it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that songs that are sad songs about people like Brad who have been killed recently, I mean, these are always moving songs for people to hear, and of course they're more moving because so many of the people and the audiences that I'm playing for around the country either certainly knew of Brad or knew Brad or they knew someone who knew Brad. I mean, Brad knew a lot of folks. He got around. He was a very active activist in all kinds of different circles all over the country and in other countries as well. We knew a lot of the same folks, and we did work in a lot of the same places all over, on, I guess, at least two continents, maybe three. So, certainly people find the song moving, you know, particularly because it's so personal.
I remember when we met, surrounded by police. Was a one block in the city where protest was allowed, and they were there to keep peace. You
said, "Hey, my name is Brad, and I think we surely will." Then began the nightmare all over once again. Revolutions, debtors' prisons, filled with good, upstanding men. We said to hell with King John Adams. Of this farce we'd had our fill, and we set our sights on liberty here in the Berkshire Hills.
The song Berkshire Hills is, of course, about Connecticut, and the Berkshire Hills are actually not very far from our studios. Talk about this theme that crops up in your work so often about people losing land.
Yeah, it's a little known fact. I mean, there are so many people who are fans of the U.S. Constitution, you know, and oftentimes if you ask them what it is they like so much about it, it's one of 10 amendments that they're particularly fond of. And those 10 amendments were not part of the Constitution. People don't realize that. People don't realize that Thomas Paine was not a signatory to the Constitution. They don't realize that these amendments were not passed with the Constitution, that we basically had a sort of bourgeois monarchy, you know, after the other, you know, England's monarchy was overthrown, that, you know, Washington became a bit of a monarch himself. And the 10 amendments were passed only as a direct result of the citizens of Western Massachusetts rebelling, taking over the state, and preventing the government from functioning, preventing the courts from functioning, preventing the landlords from foreclosing upon their farms. And these were largely folks who had been fighting in the Continental Army and in other militias in the American Revolution for years, and then they get back to their farms, and their farms are being taken from them because they were not paying back rent while they were fighting. And so people rebelled, and this was called Shays' Rebellion, and it resulted in the Bill of Rights being passed to appease the citizenry. It also resulted in the U.S. having a standing army, which it's had ever since, to protect the government from its population. And it's important that people know these things. I think Shays' Rebellion is certainly one of the seminal events in the history of this country that people need to understand what happened, why it happened, how it happened. There's a lot to learn about that for our times, and not that we can repeat history exactly like Shays' Rebellion, but there's a heck of a lot of things about it that are hopefully can be instructive for people today to understand how change happened. You know, why did the Bill of Rights get passed? You know, it wasn't because people asking nicely for it.
David Rovics, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dory. Pleasure.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to an interview with singer-songwriter David Rovics about his new CD, 10,000 Miles Away, and you can find that at his website, davidrovics.com. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact Air Traffic Controller Ursula Rudenberg, URSULA, at pacifica.org. I'm Dory Smith of Talk Nation Radio. Thanks for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.